The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We're in Kitisa. We have developed the first part of Kitisa, which we saw as a precaution against the possible dangers of Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh. Because what we have in those two parshiot, those two portions, is really man reaching, or at the level where he can be instructed, to build a tabernacle for God. I mean, this is the highest, highest level. That you are reaching to a point, as we mentioned in Tetzaveh, that the Midrash says it's as if you're bringing a light to God. That even though God is the source of all light, and God doesn't need a light from you, but the greatest gift of God to man is to enable man to give a gift to God. That sometimes the highest manifestation of love is through receiving it, not only giving. But even though you don't need anything, you let your beloved give to you. And therefore we have this very deep mystical concept that God allows man to offer him something and he will receive it. And this is the karbanot, these are the sacrifices, this is the light of the menorah. Man is offering something to God. Man is creating accommodation for God, so to speak. And man is reaching that level where he is so godlike that just as God creates a world for man, God gives man the possibility to create a world for God. And that's expressed in the Mishkan. The Mishkan is just as God has created a world to accommodate man, man is now allowed to create a world, so to speak, that will accommodate God. Of course, God doesn't need that. But that is the gift that God has given man. That God is allowing himself to become a mekabel. And this is hinted in what we said in the 18 benedictions. In the 18 benedictions, we reach the height of Ritzeh. We have the request, please take pleasure in our prayer, God, and may we restore the temple and its services, and please receive, tekabel beratzon. Receive, you become a receiver, our prayers and our sacrifices. Right? And may we see with our very eyes. This is like the loftiest level that the human being reaches, such a level of godliness that just as God creates an accommodation for man, man is allowed to create accommodations for God. Just as God is the mashpia, man becomes the mekabel, the receiver, and God the giver. God is allowing man to become the giver and God the receiver. And again, God does not need that. But at that height, at that peak, at that climax, we have something that is quite anti-climax, which is modim anachnu lach, which is we bow down and we nullify ourselves, we subjugate ourselves, we submit ourselves, and this is the balance. That at any point where God offers man that kind of divine dignity, right, it's precisely at that point that there has to be a counterbalance to then balance the human being and humble the human being. And so in a manner of speaking, Kitisa has that element of balancing man. That we have this incredible construction of the tabernacle, the opportunity for a high priest dressed like an angel, and the offering of God, whatever to God. And at that point, Kitisa kind of like brings the energy a little bit down, right, to balance things out. And Kitisa, in this balancing spirit, has the laws of Shabbos. And to a certain extent, Shabbos laws are like the final balance. And the way the Shabbos laws are put into Kitisa is right at the transition point. Because the whole time we've been talking about building the tabernacle, the whole time we're talking about molding these golden angels, right? And it all culminates in, but guard my Shabbat, as important as it is for you to build the temple, I want you to guard my Shabbat. And right after Gar Moed Shabbat, we have the story of the golden calf. So there's no doubt that there must be some kind of connection. But if the Torah plays the laws of Shabbat, the obligation of Shabbat, right at that transition point between the instructions of the creating of the tabernacle and the transgression of the creating of the golden cow, so then it would be realistic to expect that through studying the meaning of Shabbat, we will be able to appreciate how one safeguards a tabernacle from becoming a golden cow. Because that really is the question. Right? Why is it that the tabernacle is not a golden cow? And what's the difference? We have these laws that you do not create an image, some kind of intermediary. Right? You don't do that. And then all of a sudden, we're told to have these two figurines, these golden figurines, standing on the ark. And that's okay. Not only okay, the center of Jewish life. I mean, it's one thing if it's off somewhere in the corner. We're talking about, you know, could you imagine if you were studying in yeshiva, you didn't know anything about tabernacles. You would learn Judaism. You would see that its arch enemy is idol worship. And then you walk into the temple and you're overwhelmed, right? Because in the center of this temple, in the Holy of Holies, is something that looks like an idol. So how is it that the temple, what is it about the tabernacle that differ, that becomes the highest mode of expression of relationship with God, in contrast to a golden cow, which demonstrates the lowest level of transgressing my relationship with God? And yet, on the externality of it all, it looks the same. And right between the two is Shabbos. So if we learn a little bit about what Shabbos means, we could come to an understanding of how is it that Shabbos safeguards two golden figurines from becoming one golden cow. Okay? So let's talk about Shabbos. In the Parsha, chapter 31, verse 12, it says, "And you speak to the nation of Israel, ach, however, et shabtotai tishmiru, however, my Shabbos you shall guard." Now that however is really important, because here we have it. We've got all these laws to build it, the instructions to build the tabernacle, and very exciting, right? And then, right at the end of all the instructions, we are told, however, I want you to keep the Shabbos. Now it's here that we learn, as we mentioned the other day, the 39 categories of prohibited activities in Shabbat, that they are related to the activities that go into the building of the temple. Okay? So you're supposed to build the temple. However, when Shabbos comes, stop building the temple. And stop doing any activity that's similar to building the temple. Okay? So, let's think about this. Do you know what the temple is all about? The tabernacle is all about? To build the tabernacle is the fulfillment of the creation of the world. As it says in the Gemara, when the tabernacle was completed, there was no joy that filled the world since the day the world was created. Because it is the fulfillment of creation. I mean, we've been talking until now about tikkun olam, the fixing of the world. And we have the mystical metaphor of, you know, in the beginning God created a vessel and God wanted to give this vessel his light, and the vessel couldn't hold the light. So the vessel breaks. Now, the building of the tabernacle is tikkun olam. You're able to build the finite world, build yourself, build the vessel that can now hold the light. This is what we've come to the world to do. Tikkun olam. Right? The fixing of the world. So you can imagine how excited you are. Right? How energized you are. I'm certain that we're slightly impatient. Let's go for it. Tikkun olam. Let's fix the world. Come on, let's go. We're getting, right? And we're getting closer and closer. And then all of a sudden God says, but
I want you to stop and keep Shabbat. Now, that's really disappointing. I mean, do you have time? I mean, nobody wants to schlep around, right? We want to do Tikkun Olam. We came to this world. There's a purpose. We've got a purpose in this world. We want to do it. Let's build that temple. Let's draw that spirit. And let's do it. And yet there's something more important than Tikkun Olam. Something more important than the fulfillment of the purpose of creation. Do you hear this? It's called Shabbos. Why? What is that Shabbos? How is it that Shabbos is more important than building the temple, once I appreciate that building the tabernacle is really the fulfillment, the ultimate in Tikkun? How is that possible? So let's think about what Shabbat really is. We talked about it way, way at the beginning of this whole thing, of course. 6 days God creates heaven and earth. And seventh day God rests. And of course, we're all very disturbed by God resting. Oh, God has to rest. And we're even more disturbed by the fact that it seems like the seventh day was the completion of creation. And yet, how could the seventh day be the completion of creation when everything should have been finished on the sixth day, and yet we learn the Torah that it's on the seventh day that the world becomes complete? So, like, how is that possible when everything is technically finished? So what is Shabbos? Shabbos is just a day of rest. How does Shabbos contribute to the creation of the world in a way that it's not doing anything? So we talked about what Shabbos is. Shabbos is the completion of the world as a creation. As a creation. Rather than an action. In terms of activity, the world is finished the day six. But in terms of the creation, it's only Shabbos that testifies. And in a manner of speaking, completes the world as a creation. Because what makes a creation? A creation is an expression of will. That's what a creation is. A creation means you choose to begin, and you choose to stop. That's a creation. You see, one of the basic principles in Judaism is that we believe that the primary reality is a compassionate, willing divine. Hegel once said, to comprehend what is the task of philosophy. And according to Hegel, what is reason. Meaning that the is, the was is will be, the original reality, before anything we know. What is it? It's reason. We don't believe that. We say what is compassionate will. What is what we call Hashem. Now, the question is the world a product of natural, eternal laws, forces, that in a blind manner, in a compulsive way, produce a world? Or is the world the expression of a creation of a compassionate will? And that question is answered if you keep Shabbos or not. Because keeping Shabbos testifies that God stopped. It itself testifies that He also started. Because if you can stop, you can start. But if you can't stop, then I have real serious questions of whether you started at all. Is the world merely an expression of compulsive forces? Or is it a creative expression of a free will? Creation means it has a beginning, it has an end, and has a development. And, you know, to see the world as some expression or some function of these eternal laws that might, were, are, and will be, that doesn't make the world a creation. You see the difference. You see, a person could look at the world and say, oh, look at the design. There must be a creative intelligence. That's not God. Right? Because a creative intelligence isn't something you have a relationship with, nor does a creative intelligence necessarily have free will. There might be, you might believe that the what is, the primary reality, is reason, is intelligence. Right? And then you look at the world and you say, it's obviously designed. It obviously follows certain rules and patterns. That's not necessarily a God. That doesn't mean that the world is an expression of a will. Right? So, it's very possible to see the world as merely a function of natural forces and in compulsive momentum of building. But Shabbat, God stopping to create the world, is just as important as starting to create the world. Because without a beginning and an end, you don't have a creation. You have a compulsive building, but not a creation of will and direction. And therefore, Shabbos restores to the world its meaning. Because a world which is a function of compulsive natural laws is not a new world with any meaning. So there's no direction. It has no beginning. It has no end. It has no theme. It has no meaning. For a world to have meaning, it must have some kind of willful direction and purpose. You see, there's a French philosopher by the name of Henri Bergson. And Henri Bergson has this philosophy called the creative evolution. And he believes that the world is going in greater and greater levels of complexity. But for Henri Bergson, you don't need a compassionate, willful, personal God for that. There's a force, right? A primary force, which is producing, which is, you know, building, designing. But you see, Judaism has a fundamental principle. We believe in a free, compassionate, personal God. And it's that free, compassionate, personal God which is the what is, the primary reality. And the world is an expression of a compassionate, willing, personal God. That's what Shabbos testifies to. When I keep Shabbos, I am testifying that the world is a creation, I am a creature, God is my creator, and there is a relationship, there is a purpose, there is a direction. If I don't keep Shabbos, then the world went on and on and on. Right? It goes on and on and on. Okay. So the question of keeping Shabbos is the question. Do you experience, do you intuit, do you encounter the primary reality, the is, the was, is, will be, to be compulsive forces, or even one compulsive force, or you encounter the what is will be as a free willing, compassionate, personal divine? That's the question. And that's not a simple question because that has far reaching ramifications in terms of your life. Because you don't have to have some sense of accountability to a compulsive force, do you? There's no sense of meaning in a world which is an expression of a compulsive force. But a world which is an expression of a personal, compassionate God, that's different. That's very, very different. Okay. So, if the world, one second, if the world is an expression of a compassionate will, then that means that you could transcend the laws of the world. If the world is an expression of compulsive forces, principles, then you cannot transcend the laws of the world. That's the difference. Do you see the world as simply mechanistic? Is it just a mechanistic world? Or do you see the world, again, a function of compassionate will? If it's a function of compassionate will, then if you are sick, and you go to 100 doctors, and they all tell you that you've got 3 days to live, you say, okay, if it's not a compassionate will. If it's simply the expression of compulsive forces in the universe, so then, based on the laws, based on science, we look at your body, we say you've got 3 days to live, and you say, okay. Right? And you wouldn't shed a tear because there would be no way for you, no reason for you to expect anything to be different. Right? Why would you shed a tear? I mean, that's just a fact. Right? Here today, gone tomorrow. What's the difference? But if for some reason in your gut level, you say, maybe there's hope. Maybe there's a chance. Maybe there could be a miracle. Then what you're basically testifying is that you understand reality to be a function of a compassionate will. So there are far-reaching applications of how you're going to look at this and how you really behave in the world. You had a question? No, there's no will. No, there's no will. Right? It just does it because it has to do it. Right? Just as any law. There's no will, there's no personality to laws. Right? They do what they have to do. They must do what they do. Right? But do you believe that the primary reality is must? Or is the primary reality free? Right? That's the difference. You see, it goes deeper than this. Because this is the difference between worshiping God and worshiping idols. Because worshiping idols means that you're actually deifying natural forces in the universe. That's what it initially was. You know, it's appealing to the stars, the moon. All you're doing is you're deifying natural laws in the world. Right? Forces. Right? And they're compulsive forces. And you seek to manipulate those forces so that ultimately they could serve you. You're not serving them. It's really man's way of manipulating the world to serve him. Okay? Or do you believe that there actually exists a possibility of a relationship between yourself and that person, a willful, right, free-willing, compassionate divine? That's the question. So the first thing I want you to understand that Shabbos testifies that the world is a creation of will, with direction, with purpose, in contrast to a product of maybe an intelligence of some sort, right? A primary mind. But that primary mind is not necessarily free. It's just compulsive. It just does what it does. Okay? Okay. That's only one dimension of Shabbos. The other dimension of Shabbos is that Shabbos is Beini Ubein Bnei Yisrael, which is what it says over here. Ki otki Beini Ubeinechem L'dorotam L'dat Ki Ani Hashem Mekadeshchem. Right? And that Shabbos is called a Brit. Okay? Shabbos is referred to as a covenant. Okay? It's a L'dorotam Brit Olam. Verse 16. It's a Brit Olam. Now, a Brit is a relationship of intense love in Judaism. When Yonatan loved David, he gave him a Brit, expressing their uniting of soul and their incredible love. So not only does Shabbat testify that the world is a creation of a free will, Shabbat testifies that the world is a creation of a compassionate free will, a free will that seeks relationship with man, a primary reality, a divine, a God, who seeks a relationship with man, a relationship of love. And therefore, what Shabbos is Shabbos is a day of love with God. Right? Shabbos is a day of love with God, a day of relationship with God. Now, you have to appreciate, what is the difference between a religion and a science? Religion and a science, or to be more specific, that even certain religions are really sciences in terms of the definition we're going to present. A science seeks to articulate consistent patterns of reality, right? A science is based on seeking the relationship between cause and effect. Correct? That's a science. But Judaism believes that the world goes beyond science into a realm of compassion. See, if you believe that the world is the product of compulsive natural forces, then all you would expect is science. All that you would expect is cause and effect. Correct? That's all you could expect. But Judaism says that sometimes you can transcend cause and effect. And even though the particular cause should merit this particular effect, it might not. Why? Because they do not believe the world is founded upon natural laws. I believe the world is founded upon compassionate will. So, there are certain religions that are also a science. Because they don't have a personal God. They have a force that might have designed the universe. But that force is still a cause and effect force. A cause and effect force. And again, there is no room for compassion and will. There are certain religions that actually are very similar to a science. Because science is not necessarily just physical. Science could be spiritual. And so too, Judaism. Judaism, if not studied correctly, could fall to the level of a science, rather than rise to the level of personal warmth and compassionate relationship with God. Now, that is very, very possible. That's very, very possible. And I'm sure you've met people like that. Do you treat your Judaism like this cause and effect situation? If you do the mitzvahs, then the effect is you get the world to come. If you don't do the mitzvahs, then the effect is you go to hell. It's very important to understand this, because I see that this is the problem that's happening for so many people today. You see, when you keep Shabbos, what you're testifying to is that the world is a creation and God relates to man. And man relates to God. And you take a day just to relate to your fellow man, and you take a day just to relate to God. Nothing else. Nothing else. And that's crucial, because if you don't do that, then the religion of the week could end up being another kind of science, another kind of cause and effect, another kind of mechanistic lifestyle that's not built on compassion. You see, when you keep Shabbat, you are testifying that there is actually a relationship between you and God, and that what might happen scientifically might not happen. Might not happen. And that's a major difference in a person's life. I met a woman who was a doctor for many, many years. She was already 60 years old. And she said, just last year I started to believe in God. And I said, what happened? How did you start believing in God? So she said, well, I never believed in God, and I'm a doctor. And I had a case that scientifically there would be no chance for this person to live. And I witnessed a miracle. There's no scientific explanation for it the person lives. And I said, there must be a God. You see how that works? You see, once you realize that there is a possibility for something to happen that goes beyond the cause and effect of science, then what you're left with is the world is founded upon a will. A will that transcends science, a will that transcends reason, a will that transcends logic. Now that will might be the source of science, the source of logic, the source of reason, but reason, logic, and science are still subservient to that will. Still subservient to that will. So what Shabbos will do is it will safeguard your week from becoming mechanistic. How so? This gets us back to the whole idea of teaching only. You can imagine, you're so excited, you want to fix the world, right? Oh, wow, I can't wait to fix the world. And yet God says, stop. I want you to stop fixing the world. Because unless, and only if you could stop fixing the world, could your fixing the world be an expression of will rather than compulsive. You see that? Because if you're compulsive, you're not human. You're a robot. You're a machine. Just as for God, so to speak, stopping means that God has now become for us not a machine, not a natural law, but a willing God. A personal God that relates and wills and chooses. Right? Only unless you can stop doing tikkun olam will you then be doing tikkun olam as a being with free will rather than a machine which is compulsive. See, that's really important. That even the tikkun olam is done in a certain manner, right? Which is personal. A certain manner which is human-like. A certain manner which is out of will, out of choice, rather than out of compulsive. Right? You are compulsive, you cannot stop. And it's very possible that two people could really love each other, and they understand that the purpose of their existence is to love each other. But of course they want to create a house, accommodation, something that will accommodate their love. So with great zeal and excitement, they begin to build their love home. Right? In the process of building their love home, they destroy their relationship. You see that that's possible. So it's very possible that you lose sight of what the goal is and what the mean is. Tikkun olam is not the goal. Tikkun is a means to the goal, which is relationship with God. Right? The relationship with God. And it's very possible that without a Shabbos, without stopping tikkun olam, and just getting in touch with God, then even your tikkun olam is mechanistic and becomes something outside the context of the relationship with God. It just becomes another thing to do. Right? It just becomes another thing to do. So, that whole process is what can happen with your entire religion. There are some people that look like they're religious, but they're actually scientists. Right? Because their religion no longer has any level of compassion. They really have no sense of a relationship with God, nor they have any sense of a relationship with any human being that they're really from. Right? They do everything. Right? They put on their tzitzit, they put on their kippah, they put on their tefillin. They keep Shabbos, but they keep Shabbos like a machine. It's compulsive. It's not an expression of me in relationship to God as an expression of my will and my choice because this is my relationship. It's just another compulsive things that people do. You don't want to do that. Right? So, you know, sometimes you can see this when people become so concerned about the minutiae of law in contrast to concerned about hurting another person's feelings. Now, that doesn't mean that you sacrifice the minutiae of Jewish law. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that you don't sacrifice human feelings either, and you've got to take that into consideration. So I was once at the Kotel, it was a Friday night, and there was a Kabbalat Shabbat. Kabbalat Shabbat. And it was just this rabbi who was very inspiring, exciting, and everyone was singing. It was kind of late Friday night, and people were singing, and it started to rain.
So one of the fellows that was part of the minyan, didn't know better, ran over and grabbed an umbrella and opened it up and put it over the rabbi, right, on Shabbos. Now, of course, everybody knows that you're not allowed to open up or hold an umbrella on Shabbos. What? Almost everybody. But he didn't know. And with the greatest concern, real authentic care, he went about and opened up this umbrella and put it over the rabbi. The rabbi didn't say a word. Right? The rabbi didn't say a word. He just let the guy hold the umbrella over him while it was raining. Now, I was a little disturbed. I was really actually very shocked. Why did you say something? Well, from left field at the Kotel, some very religious-looking man runs over, and everyone's singing and dancing, and he stops the whole thing and runs up to the rabbi, and he says, please, in Yiddish, he says, please do not desecrate the Shabbos. Please do not desecrate the Shabbos of the Holy Kotel. Please don't open this umbrella here. Right? So the rabbi said to him in Yiddish, and all this is in Yiddish, and at least I understood Yiddish. So nobody else seemed to understand, but I understood what's going on. And the rabbi says, leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. Right? This other fellow starts saying, oh, you're desecrating Shabbos, it's Shabbos, and it's the Holy Kotel, and isn't that right? The rabbi looks at him and says in Yiddish, do you think I'm crazy? I know what I'm doing. Go away. Right? And the guy starts begging him, please, and that. Nobody knows. It's all in Yiddish, and no one knows what he's talking about. And finally, the guy, in great despair, leaves. And I have to admit that I was really kind of surprised. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know why this rabbi did not tell this guy not to close his umbrella. But afterwards, someone did come up to him privately and say, what was that all about? And he said, it's all about embarrassing a person in public. That's what it's all about. There's also a law that you're not allowed to embarrass somebody. In fact, embarrassing someone is like murder. That's why they call it halbanas panim, the whitening of someone's face, because you cause their blood to be removed from their face as if they died. Huh? And the truth is, if that rabbi in front of everyone would have said to him, a guy runs over, puts the umbrella, and then the rabbi says, close that umbrella and go away, everyone would say, oh, and the guy would have been shattered who knows for how long. And therefore, the guy already opened up the umbrella. The guy's already holding the umbrella. Halakhically, there's nothing to do at this point. Right? It's a problem to actually tell him to close it anyways. Right? It's actually a problem to tell him to put it down. Right? So even within the halakhic minutia, there's something here. But the question is, are you mechanistic? Are you a scientist? Are you afraid because you opened up that umbrella, then lightning comes tumbling down? Or do you realize there's another mechanism that halakha is nestled into, which is compassionate relationship with people? Right? Of course, it's a fine line, because some people would take that as their license to begin to become mako, to become, easy in halakha. No, it doesn't mean you can become easy in halakha. It means you have to be more strict on your sensitivity with people, so that when you are strict with your halakha, you are still very clear how to do it in a way that is like a mensch. Right? It's still like a mensch. So there are certain people, unfortunately, where the religion has become a science rather than compassion and relationship. I mean, God created the world for love. Right? That's basically, the world was created for love. Now, of course, love has rules. Right? But love has rules, and those rules are subservient to love still. Right? And you always have to be careful with that whole direction. So, what Shabbos does is it breaks the possible mechanistic lifestyle of the week. You become a human being again on Shabbos. During the week, you can become compulsive, whether it's in your business, your factory, or in your religion. Right? Even your religion. I mean, Shabbos doesn't have too many mitzvahs either. Except today, to say today is Shabbat. Right? And it's really the only real mitzvah from the Torah. You don't do anything on Shabbat. So what do? You commune with God. Right? You commune with God. You stop doing and get in touch with why you started doing in the first place. So that while you're doing it, you do not forget why you started doing it in the first place. That's why Shabbos is a source of blessing for the rest of the week. Right?
so that what you do in the week is going to be as a human being, with choice, with relationship, with personality, with warmth. Okay. So now how does that bring us to the golden calf? Because that is the sin of the golden calf. The sin of the golden calf is the Jews became scientists. They became scientists. If you think about what happened, it's a very weird story. Moses tells the people, I'll be back in 40 days. 40 days. I mean, you know, 40 days. And he's late. Things just do not work according to their calculations. Right? And if you're a scientist and things don't work out according to your calculations, what do? You lose faith. In your calculations, you lose faith in what's going on, and you come up with a new solution. Right? And that's what they did. They came up with a new solution. Well, this man Moses has not returned. It's 40 days. Things are not going according to the way we calculated, so we must create a different kind of solution. So they created a golden calf, which was not to be a substitute for God. It's to be a substitute for Moses. A substitute for Moses. What should they have done when Moses, according to their calculation, did not return? What should they have done? They should have prayed to God. They should have cried their eyes out and seek compassionate will, not logical solutions. You see, nothing's wrong with logical solutions if they come after seeking compassionate will. You get the point? Right? But they didn't. They didn't start to pray. They just right away decided that this is the problem. This is the solution. They're being very scientific about it. And they're being very scientific about it because you know what they were doing. Kabbalistically, what they were doing is they realized that they were in a desert. And a desert is under the influence of the sphira, the attribute gvura. And go is also connected to the attribute of gvura. So what they did is they created an image which would help them to direct them through an area which is dominated by the attribute of Gvura. This is all science. It might be a spiritual science, but it's a science nonetheless. Instead of appealing to God's will, his compassionate will, and say, what do we do now? What they did is they became scientists. And they said, oh, this is what we should do now. Right? They became very calculating, very logical, very practical, when all that is fine, as long as it does not happen before reaching out to the foundation of the world, which is the compassionate will of God. Well, what exactly did they do? So we once mentioned, the Nachmani says what they did was they were mekatzet v'nitiyot. They separated the reeds. Now, what is this? According to the Ramban, and it's pretty clear, their sin was more in mind than in action. Because only 3,000 of them actually ended up worshiping this idol. But that's you know, less than 1% of the people. Right? Everybody else did not in any way see this as a substitute for God. They saw it as a substitute for Moses in a way to appeal to the attribute of Gvura. It's in mind. Now, what does it mean to appeal to the attribute of Gvura? So let's mention, let's say you're in a shopping mall, and all of a sudden you see a math teacher. Do you remember you were surprised? Do you remember seeing one of your professors or your teachers in some place, like a football game, and all of a sudden you were just shocked? What are they doing here? And why are you so shocked? I mean, they are a human being. No, they're not to you. They're a math teacher. A math teacher is in a math room, right? And that's the end of it, right? That's the end of their reality. In other words, your particular perception of their reality becomes the reality rather than your particular description of the relationship. Right? And so you go up to your math teacher in the shopping mall and you say, hello, Mrs. Mary. Quite strange seeing you here. What are you doing here? She says, well, I'm shopping. You go, oh! You're a shopper. You're a math teacher shopper. I thought you were just a math teacher. Huh. You're a shopper. Huh. Okay. And who are all these little students around you? I didn't know that you taught little kids. I thought you only taught high school. These are my children. You're a mother. You're a mother. You're math teacher shopper mother. Wow. And who's this man standing beside you? He's my husband. Oh, no. You mean you're a wife? My gosh, you're a math teacher shopper mother wife. Okay. You see the problem? She looks at you and she says, I'm none of those things. Right? Beyond all of those things. These are all descriptions. These are all attributes of me, but they are not me. But they are the doorway to relating to me. Now, it's like when you would see a judge wearing his judicial clothing. And then you go golfing, and all of a sudden you see the guy wearing golf shoes and golf pants. Who's that? And you're really shocked because you took your image for their reality rather than particularly a door into their reality that goes beyond their image. That's the attribute. All the sefirot are garments. They're just garments. God is beyond all the attributes, all the names. But just as you might put up your teacher and say, your hand and say, teacher. Yes, the word is teacher, but the relationship is with the essence. It goes beyond the word teacher. Now, what they did was they appealed to one attribute. They appealed to an attribute, not to God. You see it? They became scientists. They figured, well, we'll relate to the attribute of Gvura, right? And because that, and they became very calculating, and this all makes a lot of sense. It's a spiritual science, but it's a science nonetheless. It's not a relationship. Right? And you have to understand, there's a similar problem in business. Because even relationships can become a science. That's business. Business is the science of relationships. If, when the customer comes in, you say, good morning, right? Then the customer will most probably want to buy from you. Right? If the customer says they want something in green, you say, of course we have something in green. And then the customer will say, and then you will say, and then he will say, it's all cause and effect. It's a science. Right? Are you in a world that is cause and effect? Or are you in a world which is in relationship and love? Because even though love includes cause and effect, it also transcends it sometimes. Right? And the cause and effect is only going to be meaningful if it's within the context of a relationship in an authentic way. So what the Jewish people became were scientists. They figured it all out. Right? They figured it all out. Well, Moses is not back 40 days. Well, at that point, they lose faith in Moses, right? And they create a logical solution to Moses. It was at that point they should have lost faith in their calculations and increased their faith in God. Right? You see, that's the difference? There's two types of scientists. One scientist comes up with all these various calculations, right? And it does not work out according to his expectations. So he loses faith in science. Right? But another scientist acquires new faith in God. It depends what you do with it. So the golden cow is science, and the golden proving are relationships. The difference between the golden cow and the Kruvim is God said, create these golden images, and I will rest upon them. And you did it within the context of a relationship. And even something that looks like idol worship, even something that looks like science, within a relationship is not science. But what the Jewish people did is, out of their own initiative, out of their own reasoning and logic, out of their own calculations, they decided to create a golden cow. And that's the difference. The difference is, does religion become a science, or does it maintain the heartful warmth of authentic relationship? Now, the heartful warmth of authentic relationship doesn't in any way exclude science. Right? It doesn't exclude cause and effect. There are cause and effect. A loving parent will say to their child, if you do this, you'll get that. Because I've got to teach you how to behave. I've got to teach you a sense of consequences. I've got to teach you to make the right choices. But the child also has to know, even though if you do this, you'll get X, and if you'll do this, you'll get Y, there's still a loving relationship between them and their parent. And that loving relationship still exists. And the cause and effect is an expression of the loving relationship, and sometimes you can even expect a miracle. And even though your cause does not merit that effect, sometimes your parent says, in this situation, I'll override it. So the golden cow was taking everything they'd experienced and scientizing it. You know, they met God face to face. They had these visions of the Sefirot. Right? They will reveal the names of God. But now, it's very possible that what you can do is you can take everything that you learned. You can meet somebody, and it starts off in the most authentic, most sincere level of relationship, and you take it and you make it into a science. And you destroy it. Because now you know. Everybody knows. You're supposed to say to her, I love you. And then she'll say, I love you too. And then you're supposed to give her this. And then she's supposed to then respond and give you that. And then you're supposed to do this and you're supposed to do that. And yet, even though they're not supposed to, never, never cut it out of the original context, which is that heartful, compassionate, authentic relationship. And that's unfortunately what I think you sometimes see. Not always, of course. But sometimes you see people who say they're religious, they say they believe in a God, they see the world is a function of compassionate will, and yet they act like scientists. And that everything is cause and effect. Right? Everything is cause and effect. So the golden cow is taking the tabernacle and making it into a science. Right? And Shabbos is the safeguard against that.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.